Welcome to Anatomy of a Cold Case. We are your hosts, Lindsay Wade and Mike McCann.
For our listeners, this is Dr. Kathy Taylor, and she is our Washington State forensic anthropologist. She's an amazing woman and somebody that I was lucky enough to work with for many years during my career as a detective with Tacoma PD. So thanks again for coming on the show.
Oh, I'm happy to be here.
Some people know what forensic anthropology is, but I'm guessing that a lot of people don't. So would you be kind enough to kind of tell us what it actually means to be a forensic anthropologist?
Sure. So forensic anthropology, by definition, is the application of skeletal biology to medical legal death investigation. So what that means is, as a forensic anthropologist, I am a bone expert. So whenever a human bone expert, so whenever people find bones, and the first question obviously is going to be, is it human or non-human? And I get a lot of those. There are bones everywhere out there.
Yes.
And people find them a lot. So I get called a lot by law enforcement saying, hey, you know, somebody just found a bone. Can you tell me if this is human? Do I need to secure the scene? They can text me photos. They can email me photos. And 99% of the time I can tell them that's non-human. I can't tell you what animal it is because my expertise is people or non-people. So I just tell them that's a non-people. But then on the rare occasion, it actually turns out to be human. And then I say, now you have to secure your scene, call your detectives and have your detectives call me. So that's the first thing. The second question would be, is it forensic or not? And we have quite a lot of archaeological remains that turn up in our state, not as many as other places. I did my graduate work in Arizona, and the desert preserves human remains very well. And so we got a lot of archaeological remains. Up here, the soil tends to be very acidic because we have so many evergreen trees.
Okay.
And so the remains actually degrade much faster. So we don't see as much archaeological things, but we do see them. We certainly do see them. So if something's recovered that's archaeological or non-forensic, then I'm in touch with our state physical anthropologist who works for the Department of Archaeology and Historic Preservation. And he works to, if they're Native American, to repatriate them to the appropriate tribe. So that's the second question. If it's human, is it forensic or not? And then if it is forensic, then the question, of course, is what is it? Where's the rest of the body? Who is this? And so generating a biological profile, which would include the age of the individual, their ethnicity or population affiliation, and how tall they were, and whether they're male or female, of course. And then any trauma that would suggest that this is either a homicide or not, but also past trauma that might give us some history, life history of the person. Because what's amazing is that your life history is written in your bones. So we can tell if somebody had disease or if they had past trauma that healed. Sometimes we'll see a lot of fractures, for example, on young women who lead a high-risk lifestyle, or we'll see very bad teeth in people that are potentially have drug habits. So we can tell a lot from the bones, and so we try to give that information, and then we have to figure out who they are. And that's a huge part of my job, is dealing with unidentified remains.
How did you decide to get into this field? What drives somebody to do this?
Well, I was actually pre-med my whole growing up. I always loved medicine. I always loved science. I was that science nerd, right, as a kid. And I took all the science classes. And I went to school. I went to the University of Michigan. And Go Blue has a great pre-med program. And I was pre-med and I was taking all the science classes. And then as a sophomore, I took my first anthropology class, and it was a human evolution class. And all of the fossils were laid out in front of me. And I was fascinated at how much you could tell, you know, what animal is this? What species is this? And how did they live? And what did they eat? And that just absolutely captured me. And I started taking a lot of anthropology classes, and I had a great mentor who allowed me as an undergraduate to start taking graduate classes. And I ate it up. I loved it. And I decided somewhere along the line, you know, I think part of it was that I, for some reason, ended up in engineering calculus. I don't know why I ended up in engineering calculus, but there I was, did not do well at all, almost failed, because I am not an inductive thinker. I can't think from the specific to the general. I can only think deductively. And I am a very good deductive thinker. So I thought, you know, forensics is really combining my love of the bones and reading bones with my ability to think deductively. So it was sort of that perfect match. And I abandoned pre-med and I went totally the anthropology route. And I have never looked back. I love it.
When you say think deductively, what, go with that a little bit.
So deductive thinking is going from the general to the specific. So it's taking in, for example, if I look at a skull, I'm looking at all the features on the skull and I'm deducing, I'm narrowing it down. How old was this person? Are they male or female? What's their ethnicity? How did they live? Is there anything that about them that I can tell investigators, hey, you're looking for somebody that had trauma to their head at one point and has healed fractures, or their teeth are terrible, but at one point they had restoration. So at some point in their life, they had good dental care and then something happened and their teeth fell into disrepair. And that can help figure out who this person is and what population we should be looking at and whether or not they're likely to have been reported missing. So that's deductive thinking.
Well, we're really glad that you abandoned your pre-med route and you decided to go and become a forensic anthropologist, because we love you and we love working with you. I remember taking a class that you taught. It was a Discovery and Recovery of Human Remains, I think is the name of the class. And I just remember you bringing this big box of bones into the classroom and passing them around to all the students. And, you know, we're all handling these bones. And the one thing that stuck in my head, and I guess, you know, it just resonated with me, was when you look at a bone, and, you know, we get calls all the time from citizens, my dog brought a bone home, or, you know, some bones washed up on the beach, or they were found in the woods. And the one thing that you kept on kind of hammering into us is, would this fit in your body? Like, you know,
yes.
Think about that for a second. Pick up the bone, look at it, and recognize, like, where on your body would this fit in? And if it wouldn't fit in your body, it's not human.
So yeah.
I love that.
Yeah, that is one way. I mean, because there are animals out there, and the trick is that all mammals have the same skeletal plan, but that humans are not terribly unique in that respect, that your dog and your cat have the same bones that you have, but there's a form-function relationship. So the bones are different depending on what the animal's doing. So quadrupeds, four-legged animals, their front legs are very different. Those bones, you still have a humerus and an ulna and a radius in a dog, but they're shaped differently because that's now a weight-bearing limb instead of a limb for manipulation like it is in human. And these big animals that have huge muscles and need big bones, there are some really big bones out there. So when they come in, that's the first question. Where would you put this in your body? And if you can't put it in your body, then don't worry about it. That's a non-people. I can't tell you what animal. It's a non-people.
Yes. And as a forensic anthropologist, you're able to look at bones and sometimes tell whether or not they had like trauma to their bones that could have resulted in their death. Is that right?
Yes. Yes. So not being a pathologist, so the pathologist determines cause and manner of death. So I don't determine cause and manner of death, but I identify trauma. And that can be high-speed projectile, which is gunshot trauma. It can be sharp force trauma, or it can be blunt force trauma. And that extends also to bodies that are being autopsied that have trauma. So one of my favorite things to do, this sounds kind of weird, but one of the things I really enjoy is reconstructing remains that have been fragmented by trauma. So for example, if you have an individual who's had massive blunt force trauma to their head and their head is fragmented, we can take the pieces, clean them up and reconstruct them, put them back in. It's kind of like doing a big bony jigsaw puzzle, and figure out how many times they were hit, what the probable instrument is, give law enforcement an idea. Hey, when you serve that search warrant, this is the instrument you're looking for, or something along these lines, the class characteristic, because that's the pattern we're seeing in the bone. And bone is an excellent medium for tool marks because it doesn't distort. So not like soft tissue, which is very pliable. Bone isn't pliable, so it doesn't distort, and it holds that pattern. So if somebody gets hit with a hammer, and they will have a nice round depressed fracture that reflects the head of the hammer. And we can look at that and say, hey, you know, this is consistent with some type of hammer. When you serve your warrant, look for a hammer. So that I get called in a lot on bodies that aren't skeletal. They're actually even sometimes fresh bodies, but there's trauma and they want a trauma assessment. And so that's a big part of my job.
Now, one of the other things that I believe you get involved in are situations where law enforcement believes there's maybe a clandestine grave somewhere. Can you kind of explain what your role would be in something like that?
Sure. I get called a lot for law enforcement. Will say, hey, you know, we're sure this person's been murdered, and we're looking for the body, because of course no body homicides happen, and I have testified in no body homicides, but it's much easier when you have the body. So we sit down and we really strategize. I have a whole list of questions that I ask. And in fact, I just did this on a case. So I have a whole list of questions I ask, and I start with, tell me about the victim. What are the physicals on the victim? What's the shoe size on the victim? Because oftentimes you'll have shoe wear impression evidence. And what kind of hair? Hair holds blood, and animals are attracted. They love the hair because they'll take it for nesting material. So we always want to know what the victim's hair looks like, how long it is, and then what were they likely wearing? We look at the time of year. When do you think this murder happened? What was the time of year? What was the temperature? Were the flies active, right? Are we likely to see insect activity and maggot activity? What's the ambient temperature? How fast is the body going to decompose? What was the sunset? Did this happen during the day or night? Did the person have access to light? What was the phase of the moon? If they were trying to get rid of the body at night, how much ambient light would they have? Did they have to have extra light? What was the snow on the ground? Could they dig? Was the ground frozen? I want to know about who their suspect is. What are his physicals, his or her physicals? Did he act alone? Has he ever killed before? Would he have been panicked? Would he have had to really do this quickly, or could he have taken his time? What time did the murder happen? And then when did he dispose of the body? Because we know what happens to a body after death, and one of them is rigor mortis. And when rigor mortis sets in, it's very hard to manipulate a body. So if you're in the time frame when the body was in full rigor, we have to consider that this, who's ever getting rid of this body, is going to have a much harder time manipulating that body, and they're going to have to dig a much bigger hole. So we try to do the whole time frame. We look at other things about the relationship between the perpetrator and the victim. Are they likely to revisit the scene? Oftentimes you have a murderer who has an attachment, or they think they own their victim, and they will revisit the scene either to relive or to bring other people and say, hey, you know, don't cross me because this is what's going to happen to you. We can tell some of our other resources, like our trackers. There may be evidence of human interaction at the scene multiple times if we felt that he revisited the scene, or it has to be somewhere where he can revisit the scene. So there's a whole list of things that we sit down and we go through, and then we figure out strategies for searching. What kind of resources are you going to want to use? Are you going to use ground pounders, which we, of course, go to our amazing search and rescue resources for that? Do you want trackers who can go in and find evidence of human activity? Do you want cadaver dogs? Actually, they're called now human remains detection dogs. Can you do an aerial over the area and tell us, can you see interruption in the landscape? What's the history of the landscape? Has there been floods? Have there been landslides? Just a whole lot of things that we consider when we're trying to find a body and a grave.
Wow. It sounds very, very in-depth and intense. And of course, when you actually get to a situation where you locate a grave, it's not like you just pull out the backhoe and dig it up, right?
Oh, no. In the old days, maybe. But now we have a much more of appreciation for all the evidence that's in a grave. And we don't see as many buried bodies up here because it's really hard to dig. When the glaciers came through in Western Washington, they deposited a lot of rocks. So anybody who tries to dig in their yard and finds that you go down a little ways and you hit clay or you hit big rocks, lots of times I find that the buried bodies I've done, and I've done quite a few of them, it speaks to premeditation oftentimes, because they've either dug the hole ahead of time or they've scouted up the area where they know they can dig a hole. We don't see very many where the person is got, you know, the murder's happened, I've got to get rid of this body, I'm going to go bury it. Usually those are bodies that are dumped on the surface and not buried.
KT, I first talked to you, I don't know, it's been probably 5 or 6 years. I found out about you on the NAMIS website for unidentified remains, and I noticed that you were not the custodian, but the conduit for any Jane Does or John Does in the state. Can you talk a little bit about that, what your role is in managing, if you will, the Jane Does and the John Does?
Sure. So I'm actually the state anthropologist, and so I cover the entire state. And whenever they have a county has an unidentified, they will call me. And we try, there's a lot of resources we have at our disposal right now. For example, we have CODIS, which is means that we can get their DNA into CODIS and it can run against family reference samples. So if somebody has a missing person and they go to the police and they report that person missing, two things should happen. One is that the law enforcement will obtain that person's dental records and submit them to the state. And those will be input into NCIC, which is National Crime Information Center, for comparison against John and Jane Doe's. And they will collect family reference samples for the individual that's missing. And that goes into a database that's DNA. It's just a cheek swab. It's real simple. And that goes into a database in CODIS, which is the DNA, federal DNA database, so that when we get a John or Jane Doe, we take their dental x-rays, we submit them to the state to run against all the dentals of missing persons that are in there, and we submit their DNA to run against the family reference sample database. And we've had hits in both, absolutely in both. But then we have a large population of unidentifieds that remain unidentified because they're not hitting in CODIS and they're not hitting in the dental database. And those are the ones that, gosh, eat at me, because you know somebody's missing these people. And if we have to be able to figure out who they are. And I have unidentifieds. We have Green River victims that have never been identified. And we know I've got unidentifieds from 20, 30 years ago.
How many in Washington State, Kathy, total unidentifieds?
I haven't done a count recently, but I can tell you in King County alone, we're over 40. Mm-hmm. So in the state, I would say we're probably close to 100 if we go historically. I mean, there's a lot. There's a lot. And probably the greatest success in my job is when we get one of those bodies identified and we can make contact with the family and we can tell them what happened to their loved one. I just recently did a young man who was a suicide in 1984. And I just got him identified because the family went on NamUs. Now, NamUs is a national database, and it is accessible to the public. And we post information on our unidentifieds on NamUs. And the great thing is that the families, the public, can go on and start doing searches if they're missing somebody. NCIC is not available to the public. In fact, not even available to medical examiners. That's a law enforcement database. So NamUs really filled a hole, a gap, that allows families that are missing somebody to be proactive and do something. They can go on and search. And so I had a family that went on and searched for their missing, in this case, it was her missing uncle that she had always known about, but no one knew what happened to him, and reached out to me and to my office, and we were able to identify him. And he had died in 1984.
Wow.
We were able to fill that hole in their family tree. So, and I told her when I talked to her, I said, you know, I would dance around my office right now if I could, because that's how good it feels to be able to answer those questions for these families.
Absolutely. Wow. That's pretty fantastic. And yeah, I know you and I have talked over the years about some of the pitfalls and some of the loopholes with our whole system regarding missing persons and unidentified remains. On a previous episode, Mike and I talked about this because we interviewed Detective Lindsay Schultz about the Fly Creek Jane Doe case, which I know you were part of that.
I know it well.
Yeah. And, you know, just this whole issue of people not being reported missing, and how could that be? I think that the public probably would be surprised to hear how often people are not listed in any missing person database.
Right.
Even though everyone knows they've been gone and, you know, the family, you know, knows they've been missing for so many years, but either they really didn't think they were truly missing, like they thought they ran off with somebody, or either they may have believed that they did report the person missing to law enforcement, but for whatever reason, they never made it into a missing person database. I'm sure that you agree it's so important for people who do have missing loved ones to reach out to law enforcement and
Yes. Just
verify that law enforcement actually does still have their case and that, you know, their missing loved one is in NCIC and that, you know, the family reference samples have been collected and that, you know, hopefully they're in NamUs as well.
Right. And what I always tell families, and I do a lot of counseling with families that'll call because they're missing someone, and they'll say, hey, I don't want to be making this phone call, but law enforcement, in order to report them missing, they're telling me I have to check the quote unquote morgue. So do you have anybody that matches this description of my loved one? And I will say, No, fortunately, we don't right now. And I will counsel them, this is what you need to do, right? This is what you, how you need to report them missing. You need to make sure that you find if they have dental x-rays, if they have x-rays of any part of their body. Actually, we can identify somebody from any x-ray of their body. Your skeleton is that unique. There are parts that are better than other parts, but the chest is not the best. But for example, there's a frontal sinus that's right above your nose, and it's in your forehead. And the size and shape of that is as unique to the individual as their fingerprint is. And we see that on an x-ray. So if they've ever had a CAT scan of their head, there's a, what's called a scout film where they x-ray the head first. I can use that and make a positive ID if I have a skull or I have an individual that I can take an x-ray of their head. So we ask them for any x-rays of any medical x-rays, put a hold on them, call the hospital, tell them not, you know, to hold on to them, get the dental x-rays. Fortunately, now everything's digital, or mostly everybody's digital. And that means the images are retained a lot longer. In the old days, hard copy x-rays used to be destroyed after 7 years. So a lot for our older unidentified x-rays are gone. But in the old days too, and by old days, I'm talking 70s, 80s, and even into the 90s, the computer systems weren't great. We didn't have, I mean, NCIC for missings didn't come online until I believe it was 1977. So there weren't computer databases. And there was this belief in law enforcement that adults in particular have the right to disappear. And that really thwarted our ability to have records on missing people. Families would get very frustrated. They go in and try to report somebody missing, and they were told, well, they're an adult, they have a right to disappear. So now the whole culture around missing and unidentified has very much changed. And law enforcement is much more receptive. They take those reports. They know what they have to do. But I tell the family, be persistent. Do a follow-up. Call. Make sure that case is still in the computer and in the system. And call me on occasion and double check, right? Do you have anybody that matches this description? The families need to be proactive, and they need to follow up and advocate for their missing loved one. That's how we're going to get these people ID'd.
Well, then there's the other quirk, Kathy, that you and I talked about, and Lindsay and I have as well, as your loved one went missing when they were a juvenile. They were 16.
Oh, yeah.
And then what I found out through you was when that individual, when their 18th birthday came around, they would fall out of the system because they came an adult.
Right. They would drop out of NCIC. They would, because they were no longer a juvenile. So they were in the system as a juvenile. And when they hit 18, they were no longer a juvenile. So they dropped out.
Even though they'd been reported missing.
Right. Right. And that's another problem. I mean, our for example, our unidentified Green River girls, at least two of them are juveniles when they died. And one of them, I think, is very young. I think she's probably 12 to 15. And they, if they were reported, did they drop out when they chronologically would have hit 18? We don't know. We don't know why we're not getting those girls ID'd. We have their DNA in. We've got their dentals in. But those cases are old enough that a lot of those family members are probably gone. They've probably passed away. And so our ability, we're really on a time clock to get these kids ID'd, because pretty soon we're not going to have family that's going to know. So yeah, it's historically, and so one of my soapbox issues whenever I get an interview is, if you reported someone missing in the 70s and the 80s and even into the 90s, please call and re-report them, because odds are a lot of those cases in the days before computers and good computers, those cases were on paper and those papers don't exist anymore. So re-report, get those cases back into the system. I've got two females, for example, from Tolt Hill. Mike, you know them well.
Yes, I do.
That are unidentified and probably related. We don't know who the likely perpetrator is, but one was found in 1969 in Tolt Hill, which is now, of course, completely developed. And then we found a partial cranium in 2006. And when we looked at the map, it was maybe a block away from where the body was found in 69.
Geographically, Kathy, for those that aren't familiar, where is Tolt Hill?
Yeah, Tolt Hill is outside of Carnation. And we looked at, you know, this is 1969. So we had to think about Bundy. We had to think it's too early for Green River, but...
And Carnation in relation to Seattle.
East, kind of a little bit northeast of Seattle. I don't know how many miles outside, but back in 1969, it was a rural area. I mean, it was all woods, right, with horse trails. Now there's a thriving suburbia out there. But back in 69, it was very, very rural. So we still don't know who those two women are. And we've done everything we can to try to figure out. And they're likely homicide victims, right? So it would be nice to know, did we have a different serial killer operating in 1969 that we don't know about? We tried everything. And when I do an NCIC search on women reported missing in 69, there's only five that are in the system because they had to be retroactively added when NCIC came online in 77. And we've already ruled out all five of those women. So to this day, don't know who they are.
And now with the advent of forensic genetic genealogy, is that playing a role in helping to identify some of these John and Jane Doe cases?
Yes. Oh, yes, absolutely. And it's funny because first we had DNA, right? So if you go back to the 80s when DNA wasn't on the radar, and you think, oh, what? We're just going to wait. There's going to be another tool, right? So up pops DNA, and we solved tons of cases by DNA. I thought, okay, now there's not going to be. Could there be another tool? Could there be another tool? I don't know. Yes, up pops forensic genealogy. Yay, right? Here's another tool. And when I came on 24 years ago, I said, we cannot cremate unidentifieds. We cannot cremate unidentifieds. No, I know it costs more money to bury them, but we're not cremating unidentifieds because we don't know what tool's on the horizon or what tool's going to pop up. And so now we're using forensic genealogy. It's still in its infancy, and there are cost issues, right, with forensic genealogy. But when we can and we have the resources, I am all for that. I have a number of cases. I have a list of cases I want to go for on forensic genealogy once I have the opportunity to do so.
I can think of a couple off the top of my head, Kathy.
Right, right. I can start naming them for you, right? There's a lot that I would like to see.
And in order to do that, you still have to have some bone or tissue or some kind of DNA available to actually do the genealogy testing.
Yes.
So if they've been cremated and there's no DNA available, then
forget it.
Yeah.
Well, and Kathy, even since you and I have began speaking a couple of years ago, I think just how much the technology has changed too, right? The number of the threshold to
loci.
Thank you, Lindsay. the number of loci has changed, and it changes all the time, right? What the thresholds were, they come down each year, right?
Right, they do. And as the DNA technology gets better, they're better able to get profiles out of the bone. So that's the problem. Television has grossly distorted how people conceive of DNA. And I've watched some nonfiction or some fiction crime shows, you know, that where they take the DNA and they put it in the machine and it goes bloop, 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 and then match, right? And
that's not the way it works.
That's not the way it works. No. And oftentimes we don't get enough DNA to even be able to get a match. And the statistics aren't high enough because the bone is too degraded or the specimen's too degraded. And mitochondrial DNA, for example, right? So you have two types of DNA, right? You have nuclear DNA and you have mitochondrial DNA. Mitochondrial DNA is passed through the maternal line. And that's great largely as a rule out. So if we have somebody we think this might be, if the mito doesn't match as the maternal line, you have to have a maternal relative to submit the reference sample. We can rule them out. But if it does match, the statistics aren't strong enough to provide a positive ID in most cases. We really rely on nuclear. And if the sample is very degraded, for example, the one partial cranium we have from 69, we didn't get a full profile out of her because that bone is very degraded and the skull's not the best place to go for DNA to begin with. And then it's been out there for 40 years. So you really have to have a good sample. You have to have a full profile, and that doesn't happen all the time. So everyone says, oh, they can just do DNA. Well, no, you can't always just do DNA. It doesn't always work. And the other thing to think about is it's not instantaneous. We don't put it in a machine and get a match right away. I will wait sometimes 10 months to get a DNA profile back.
How have the amplifiers helped that, Kathy? So, you know, going back to the skull, and I'm assuming you're talking about Toll Hill Jane Doe?
Yes.
Okay. So with the amplifiers, though, if they can extract some level of biological evidence, can they amplify it?
Yes, they can. But you're really looking for good statistics to prove identity, right? We're really looking for upwards of 10,000. So they'll say the odds that this is not this individual is not related to Jane and John, who have given their family reference samples, is greater than, it has to be greater than 10,000. The odds against it, the odds against it being related. And sometimes we get what are called kinship indexes that are, is a measurement, the statistical measurement of how likely this person is to be related to the family reference samples. Like I have a case right now where it's very low, and it's just because we're not getting enough DNA out of what little we have on the case. They can amplify it, but if the DNA isn't there, you can't amplify something that's not there. So it doesn't always work. And that's what people need to know. And the genealogy, for example, is also using a completely different profile than what CODIS is using. And they need a lot more DNA. So it's not going to be applicable to every case. And DNA has revolutionized our ability to identify people. And certainly on the crime aspect, on identifying suspects, but it is not the magic bullet that's going to solve every case.
Can you think of a case that you've worked on in your, what did you say, 24-year career?
Yeah, I just hit my 24-year mark with the county.
What's one of the most interesting cases that you've been involved in, if you could share?
You know, people ask me that all the time, and they want to know about the most interesting case I did. And I think people are always looking, they expect me to say one of the high-profile cases. Right? Mm-hmm. And I've worked on some high-profile cases, serial killer cases, you know, whatever. But those are not always the ones that mean the most to me. Mm-hmm. Sometimes it's the case that I was able to really help a family or really connect with a family or really answer questions that mean the most to me, where I feel like I've made a difference. Mm-hmm. Regardless of, I the joke is that I'm always the person at a crime scene that hides behind the tree because I don't want to be on TV. And I don't like giving interviews, and here I am giving you one, but I don't, in fact, my neighbor always teases me because she'll come out, she'll meet me at the mailbox and say, "Hey, I saw your backside on the TV." I'm like, "No, thanks. I appreciate that you could identify my backside on the news." So I'm always hiding, and that's the big joke, you know, "Oh, Taylor, media's here, hide behind your tree." But I like the cases where I connect with the families. And honestly, I learn something new from every case I do. So you never want to think you know everything. You never want to think there's nothing new to learn, because I learn every case I do. But I will tell you, I had a case that I inherited when I started with the county in 1996. And it was the skeletal remains of a female who was found down off of Airport Way in 1989. So I inherited the case. And at the time, they were not able to identify her. Her cause of death was a shotgun wound to the torso, because there were still shotgun pellets lodged in her bones. And that was very unusual. They thought, well, of course, Gary Ridgway was big at the time, but that didn't fit his MO at all. So who is she? They did everything they could to try to identify her with what they had available. Of course, DNA was not on the menu then. Couldn't get her ID'd. So I inherited the case, and the first thing I did was I called Natalie Murray, who's the forensic artist I work with, and she's fabulous. And I said, "Hey, can you do a reconstruction off the skull so I can at least have a visual? Because humans are very visual animals. If I put out a press release that's just words on my unidentified, people aren't going to read it. But if I got a picture there, people are going to get drawn to that story."
So this is like a composite sketch of what the individual might have looked like?
Right. So we take the skull, and once I figure out is it male or female and what the likely ancestry is, then Natalie does the tissue depth markers based on the sex and the ancestry. We put the tissue depth markers all over the skull and then take a picture of it. And then she uses that to reconstruct the face. So she got me this drawing, and I looked at it, and it wasn't very attractive. And a very elongated face. And I called her and I said, "Are you sure? Are you sure this is what she looked like? Because this is an unusual looking female." And she said, "No, that's what the skull's telling me." And I said, okay. So we put it out, didn't get any hits, nothing. Years later, jump ahead to, gosh, what was it, 2011 probably? And Tom Jensen, who was with on King County SL, he called me because he had been going through mugshots of women who had disappeared during Gary Ridgway's time. And he knew about this case, and he had seen the reconstruction. And he called me and he said, "You got to see this mugshot." So he sent it to me. And I knew, I'm like, oh my gosh, that's her. There can't be two people that have that elongated face. That's her. So I said, Tom, that's her. Who is it? He said, Rita Lang. Well, turns out Rita Lang was a complete alias. She had used the alias. She had lots of aliases. We had no idea what her real name was. So how can we connect with her family if we don't know what her real name is? So we put out press releases, said, hey, do you know Rita Lang from 1989? She was a homicide. She went by the name Rita Lang. I called Harborview. There were lots of Rita Langs, apparently. None of them were going to be our Rita Lang. No idea who she was.
Harborview's the hospital in Seattle.
Right, right. The big trauma hospital. That's on we are on the Harborview campus. Our office is located on that campus. So we're puzzling. We're like, we're so close. We are so close. We have her picture, but we don't know what her name is. So, and that's so unusual, right? That never happens. So when we were looking at her arrest record, we realized that her very first arrest was in the Sacramento area. And I said, you know, most people get arrested for their very first time near their home. So we worked with law enforcement and we got a local station in Sacramento to run the story on the news. And half an hour after that story ran, her sister called in and said, that's my sister. That's Celia Victor. That's not Rita Lang. That's Celia Victor. So when I picked up the phone and talked to her sister, I said, I have been waiting over 20 years to talk to you.
Oh, my goodness.
And we ended up getting DNA, family reference sample DNA, and proving that it was, in fact, her.
How did that phone call go, KT?
You know, the sister was just a lovely person, and she gave me a lot of background on Celia and how she ended up being where she was. But she was very grateful. She was very, and they claimed her immediately that we had a funeral home showing up to release the remains.
Wow.
So she went home.
Did they know that she was in Seattle or had they reported her missing at all?
They had not. They didn't know what had happened to her. She was estranged from her family. She was living a difficult lifestyle and a lifestyle where she wasn't in contact with her family, but they loved her and they wanted her immediately. To put her to rest. And that's where she belongs, right? She belongs at rest with her family. She does not belong in our long-term evidence storage.
And that just shows you something, because you and I have talked about like the victim down in Lacey in Thurston County and Toll Hill Jane Doe's. This is somebody's daughter. This is somebody's sister. And regardless of what happened in their lives, somebody loves them. And isn't it amazing? You look at a woman who's involved in prostitution, but as soon as her picture goes, her sister calls. And,
right.
And obviously somebody cares.
Somebody cares. And that's the thing you learn about in this job. One of the first things you learn is that everybody matters. And it doesn't matter if they run a large-scale company or they live in a tent. Everybody matters. Everybody is loved. Everybody is missed. So you know when you haven't, that's why unidentifieds are so incredibly frustrating, because until we can figure out who they are, we can't figure out who's missing them. But you know somebody out there is missing. Somebody out there wants to know what happened to them. Somebody out there has a big hole in their life or in their heart or in their family because they don't know what happened to this person. And we hold that key, but we can't figure out what that key is. We can't figure out who they are to reconnect everything. But when I had another case in 2009, and we pulled him out of the Green River, and we didn't know who he was. And I got him ID'd a couple years ago just because I put him up in Namus, and he had a very interesting tattoo. He had a New York Yankees tattoo, and I put that in Namus. And his sister was looking for him. She lived in, I believe, Texas. She went on Namus, and she searched by tattoo because she knew her brother had this interesting tattoo. So she searched by the tattoo. Up pops my case. So she called me, gave me a name. I was able to get x-rays on him and positively ID him after, I believe, 5 years.
Wow.
5 or 6 years. And his elderly mom called me and left me a message on my voicemail that I will never forget. And basically thanking me for taking care of her son and letting them know what happened to him. And again, funeral home showed up the very next day. And he went to a funeral home. So those are the case. That's why I do my job, right?
Yeah.
That's why I do. I mean, the high profile cases.
That's what makes you a rock star. Is you by nature you're very clinical in what you do, but yet there's this this empathetic side, this caring side that really drives you, and it's amazing.
Well, thank you. But I have to say, I consider it a great privilege to have a job where I can make a difference. Because, isn't that what we all want, right?
Yes.
Is to make a difference. And I am lucky to have a job where I can do that.
Yeah. Well, we greatly appreciate all the work you do for our state. And it's always been a pleasure for me working with you. I sometimes think of you like a doctor detective, because I think you think more like a detective than probably most doctors do. But that's the great thing about you, is that, you think outside the box, and you're not just thinking about, the bones, you're thinking about the whole scenario and the whole story. And I love that about you.
Well, thank you.
KT, what's next on the horizon in terms of technology? What's the next frontier? What would you like to see for the next tool that would aid you in doing your job?
I would love to see forensic genealogy might be a much more accessible resource. And for that, it's going to take funding for law enforcement and for medical examiners and coroners to be able to use it. So that's a big hurdle. But funding's a hurdle in everything, right? I mean, that's always the big hurdle. But I would love to see forensic genealogy be much more of a standard go-to, instead of what it is right now, is sort of that extraordinary go-to. Oh, we actually secured some money. Let's try it.
Mm-hmm.
Right. I would love to see that. I would also like to see, Washington's way ahead of most states in the way we handle missing persons. I sat on a missing person task force several years ago under Governor Gregoire, all the way back actually in 2003. Which just seems like a several years, but actually is quite a long time ago. And Washington is very proactive in really addressing the missing and unidentified persons problem. But there are states where that's not true. And there are states that don't know who's missing and who's unidentified. And I would really like to see more of a attention paid to the missing unidentified persons problem nationally, not just in our state, but nationally, because people don't always die in the state they went missing in. And right now, one of our biggest problems right now is that we have CODIS, a very awesome CODIS, right? Canada has a CODIS. They don't talk to each other. There's no way to run. I mean, we have to manually get a profile and send it up to Canada and ask them to run it through their CODIS. There's no connection there. And then you think, I've got a guy who actually jumped off a high rise in downtown Seattle a couple years ago, 2018. And I don't know who he is. And his restorations in his mouth, the forensic odontologist said, these are foreign. So he's from somewhere not in the U.S. How do I figure out who he is? There's no international CODIS. The system is great, but it's not connected. We have so far to go to connect this internationally, and even just between us and Canada. I mean, if you live in Oklahoma, who cares? Because, you're Oklahoma. You probably don't have Canadians in Oklahoma. But in Washington, we're a border state. We get a lot of Canadians. And in fact, we just identified, I don't know if I should be saying this, but we just identified a body that washed up in Washington in the water. And turns out he went into the water in Canada. So, and ended up in Washington. That's happened to me several times. So I would love to see technology get to the point where different countries and their CODIS systems and their whatever their system is, where we can start connecting them. So that I could say, hey, I got a foreigner. I don't know where he's from, but here's his DNA profile. Can you run it in all these other countries and tell me if he's going to hit anywhere?
Yeah, that just seems absurd to me. You think of the border, how many miles that our country borders Canada. And the idea that our citizens, their citizens don't cross borders and end up dead in either country, that's ridiculous. Right. So, I mean, why isn't there some type of a combined database?
Well, hopefully someday, right? Hopefully. I mean, right now we have good connections with Canada, just where if we get a profile, we can say, hey, we've got this profile. Could you run it? But it takes legwork, like old fashioned legwork, right? To get that profile run. It's not automatic. There isn't an easy way to do it. And I think about all, as you said, all the states that border Canada and then all the states that border Mexico, right? We're seeing that a lot with the migrant problem down in the border states of with Mexico. But what about all the border states that border Canada, right? We have the same problem. People cross the border, and if they end up dead, whether it's by homicidal means or not, that's not what's important. What's important is who are they, and let's get them identified. So we need advances. We need a better system. And I'm hoping that that will happen in the future.
Yeah. And, you know, here's another thought. We've got, you know, in our state, I think several thousand people that have long-term felony warrants in the system. So, you know, these are people that a warrant was issued for their arrest. You know, maybe they didn't show up for court, or maybe they absconded from their parole or whatever. And, you know, some of these folks have basically been like unaccounted for decades, but they're not reported missing. You know, they're not in NCIC as a missing person. They just are in NCIC with having a felony warrant. It would be really interesting to see if there'd ever be a way to cross-reference those two things. Undoubtedly, some of those folks who are have these long-term warrants are probably unidentifieds.
Yes. Yes, I would totally agree.
But, you know, there's really no way to cross-reference those two things. So, you know, that's another large pool of candidates out there.
Yeah. And again, DNA is great, but in some ways, we're still in our infancy in terms of how we manage those databases.
Yeah.
And let's work to connect them all and figure out ways that we can cross-reference and clear warrants and figure out where these people are and figure out who's lying in morgues as unidentified people. That would be, and I've got quite a lot. In fact, I'm working today to get, I have an unidentified that came out of the Snoqualmie River, and we don't know who he is. And Natalie has done a great postmortem drawing for me, and I'm going to put that out and hope that somebody recognizes him and can say, call in and say, hey, you know that, maybe that looks like John. And then I can research John and see if it's John. I have so many that I just cross my fingers every day for that one phone call or somebody to call and say, I'm missing somebody. Do you think you have them?
We so appreciate all the work that you do. And we are just delighted that you came on our podcast. I know you're very busy and you've got lots of cases to work on, but thank you so much. We really appreciated it. And I know that our listeners are going to love hearing all the things that you had to say. And who knows, maybe you're going to influence some young person to say, you know what, I think that sounds like an interesting career.
You are a rock star, KT.
Thank you. You know, the feeling is mutual. I am great respect for both of you and what you do. And I'm thankful for both of you. And it's been a pleasure. I appreciate that you invited me. So thank you.
In our next episode.
In 87, we had investigated Gary Ridgway. And during that investigation, we got a saliva sample from him.
Anatomy of a Cold Case is produced by Lindsay Wade and Mike McCann.